Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You may have seen the New York Times Sunday magazine on April 23rd. Should a chimp be able to sue its owner? Well, there was a question we just couldn't ignore. The person who is the focus of the article is our guest this hour, Steve Wise. Stephen is president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont, Lewis and Clark, University of Miami, and St. Thomas Law Schools, and he has taught animal rights law at Harvard Law School and the John Marshall Law School. He's the author of Toward Legal Rights for Animals and Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights. The story starts with his pulling his rental car in front of this compound in Gloversville, New York, in October of last year, and he encounters Tommy, a chimpanzee, and Tommy is in a cell that's messy and it smells, and there are bits of soiled bedding strewn around him, and we'll hear the story here, but Tommy has gone on to he could never have anticipated that, as the article says, he was about to make legal history. That's the chimp, the first non-human primate to ever sue a human captor in an attempt to gain his own freedom. Our guest has been working on this issue for a long time and said it's a 25-year project. And the more we learn about the capabilities of certain animals, and we'll learn about other animals, I'm sure, in the years ahead, This becomes an issue that more and more people are taking seriously. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Should a chimp be able to sue its owner? That's essentially the question of the hour. Or an elephant or some other high-reasoning animals. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can find us at K Dunn Show. Stephen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Tell me, you've had an interesting life here. At what point did you decide, you had sort of an aha, awakening moment, that this is what you were going to do, and by golly, you were going to spend your life on this kind of work?
That was, I read a book by the philosopher Peter Singer in 1980 when I was a very young lawyer, and I began to, I just did not understand how we treated non-human animals, and the more I thought about it, the more outraged I became, and I realized I could not forget it even if I wanted to, and I thought that I would use my legal training to do what I can to make their lives better, and that eventually turned into a conclusion. The only way that was going to happen was if they became legal persons with the capacity for legal rights.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about encountering Tommy, as the Times article describes, and about how Tommy has been making legal history.
Certainly. Tommy's kind of the endpoint of a long, long strategy. In 1985, I made the decision that that the only way that Tommy or any other non-human animal was ever going to be visible to judges and going to have their interests respected was if they stopped being legal things, which meant they had the capacity for no rights at all, and became legal persons, which meant that they had the capacities for at least one or more legal rights. And I understood that the legal system was not ready for that, and it was going to be a long-term project, which in 1985 I actually thought it was going to be 30 years before we'd be able to file the first suit, because there was a lot of groundwork to lay. And by about 2007 I had decided that groundwork had been laid. I formed what became the Non-Human Rights Project, and we moved up to about 60, 70 volunteers, a lot of them lawyers, but also sociologists, natural scientists, mathematicians, law professors, law students, and everyone was working towards these first suits. And we spent about 30,000 hours preparing for the first suits, and that included asking about 60 legal questions and trying to find the answers in each of the 50 states. So we actually asked about 3,000 separate questions and tried to then rank each of the states in terms of how favorable or at least not hostile they might be to the sort of arguments that we wanted to make, which were primarily habeas corpus issues. The question is, could Tommy file a common law writ of habeas corpus, or any non-human animal seek their and obtain their freedom by filing a common law writ of habeas corpus?
Mm-hmm.
And we decided on Easter Sunday of 2013 that New York State was going to be the state that would be the jurisdiction for the first suits. And we actually chose as our first plaintiffs two other chimpanzees. And they were being held in a roadside zoo in Catskill, New York. And I went to see them. And I learned that one of them, the female, had died 3 weeks before, which left us with one of them. When we were about 8 weeks from filing our suit, we went back to check on him and found that he had died the day before, which upset us so much that we decided that we would canvass the entire state of New York and file common law writs of habeas corpus on behalf of every chimpanzee we could
identify
in that state. So we were able to, we began looking for them, we thought that based on an internet search that there may be two chimpanzees in this little town in central New York called Gloversville. And so I rented a car and I went there, and we looked at another roadside zoo which appeared from its website to have a chimpanzee, but when we went there we found that the person putting together the website could not tell the difference between a chimpanzee and a monkey, and they didn't actually have any chimpanzees. So we went on, and we saw Tommy. I was able to get onto the property and be invited onto the property, and eventually we were taken to see Tommy. And there he was in a cage, in a bank of cages. There were about 10 empty cages, and he was in the only cage that was that had anyone in it, and he was in kind of a tiny room in a large warehouse on a piece of property that sold used trailers. And he looked pretty sad to me, and so we decided that that he would be the first non-human animal, the first chimpanzee that would be the petitioner in our writ of habeas corpus. Then I went on to Niagara Falls, and we found two more chimpanzees in a cement storefront that had a lot of monkeys and exotic birds, and we decided that they would be our second and third petitioners. And then we learned that there were almost certainly two chimpanzees who were being used for biomedical research at Stony Brook University on Long Island, and those were our fourth and fifth. Before we could get the suits filed, one of the two chimpanzees in Niagara Falls also died. So that means that three of the seven chimpanzees who were alive in New York State in March of 2013 were dead by the time we were able to file suit in the first week of December 2013.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, the article says that as recently, you mentioned 2007, the article says as recently as 10 years ago, your efforts would have been laughed out of a courtroom, but now we have learned so much in the science community about the from neurological and genetic research that shows that animals like chimps, they mention elephants, orcas, and some others, show self-awareness, self-determination, and a sense of both the past and the future, and they have their own distinct languages, which sets them apart?
Well, what it does is let's see, how can I explain this? We came up with certain kind of causes of action that would support our writ of habeas corpus, certain kinds of legal theories that would support our writ of habeas corpus. And one of the arguments was that as a matter of liberty, that any being who was autonomous, you know, who could live a life in which that they self-determined, they did not live only by instinct. They weren't pushed around by any external factors, but the way they were put together, their minds and their brains, they were autonomous. And autonomy, indeed, is what's protected by a common law writ of habeas corpus. So we knew, or I knew, because, well, one reason is that Jane Goodall is a member of my board of directors. I've known her now for more than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been following the research about the minds of chimpanzees very closely for 20 or 30 years. And I was positive that the science had reached a point by 2013 that we could prove that chimpanzees had minds. They were conscious, self-conscious. They had theories of mind. They were autonomous. They could self-determine. So we began to canvass the ape experts around the world and ask if they would file affidavits in support of us and that we could use to prove that chimpanzees were autonomous. And so we found experts in Japan, Sweden, Germany, Scotland, England, and the United States. And together they filed about 100 pages of affidavits in which they gave great detail about what kind of scientific experiments had been done, how they were done, and how they demonstrated that chimpanzees had extraordinarily complex cognitive abilities. And we listed 50 or 60 of them and showed that altogether that these creatures were certainly autonomous. And in fact, some of the scientists said they were autonomous and they could self-determine. So that's what we brought to the court, and that's what we think is very powerful scientific evidence. And we think that when judges weigh the power of the facts we've brought and they understand what our legal theories are, that they will indeed agree with us that Tommy and other chimpanzees, at least, ought to move from the status of a legal thing in which they are entirely at our mercy, and they're seen as a car or a chair. They're essentially invisible to the civil process. Uh-huh. They don't have civil rights of any kind. That they should move them over to being a legal person, which means they have the capacity for at least some legal rights, and the right that we're arguing that Tommy and the other three chimpanzees should have is the right to bodily liberty. They should not be imprisoned against their will, and that a judge should issue a common law writ of habeas corpus, and then send them to the sanctuaries that we have prepared to take them, where they'll live the rest of their lives, you know, in the sun, with dozens and dozens of other chimpanzees, and they'll live the life of a chimpanzee and not of an imprisoned autonomous mind, all by themselves, with no other chimpanzee, and essentially in solitary confinement.
Yeah, you must be shaking up more than a few courtrooms, Stephen.
Well, we're hoping. We had two sets of oral arguments already. We posted the transcripts of them up on our website, which is www.nonhumanrights.org, and we are heading toward the first appellate confrontation in either October or November in 2013, and we plan, I spent 30 years getting ready for this, and now we're at the starting line, and we are ready to go.
So was Tommy able to go with you into the courtroom?
No, we wouldn't want Tommy in the courtroom.
Oh, you wouldn't?
No. Chimpanzees would have no idea what was going on.
And
this chimpanzee would have been, has been essentially in jail for almost, virtually his entire life. So we waived our right to have his body brought into court, because habeas corpus means essentially produce the body, and you can waive that.
We don't want
Tommy in the courtroom, but we want to talk about Tommy and show who Tommy is, how he's being kept, and we want him out of there.
Do you feel that the legal community, that the judges, et cetera, are taking you seriously, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely.
Are they?
If you look at the transcripts, we were taken very seriously. We were also complimented on the fact that that we had extraordinarily good papers, good arguments, but we were at the lowest trial-level court. And one judge simply said, I'm not going to be the first to take that leap of faith. And we can understand. He's just a trial judge.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to be the first to say that a chimpanzee is no longer a legal thing but a legal person. And so we had our cases set up and poised to take good appeals. And so as you go higher up the courts, the judges there are more prepared to listen to what we're saying and actually change the law. And so that's what we're hoping to do, to bring the arguments in front of the appellate courts in New York And other than that, we're already beginning to plan our next cases, which will likely be on behalf of elephants outside the state of New York. And we have lots and lots of other cases that we are planning all over the United States.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. I'm sure we'll have more than a few this hour. Stephen Wise is our guest this hour. He's president of the Non-Human Rights Project, and we're talking about the legal work, writ of habeas corpus on behalf of Tommy the chimpanzee, but they're just beginning all the courtroom work involving these. Well, he'd like for them to be not considered things, that they're autonomous and they should be legal persons, in which case they would be entitled to the right to not be held in captivity. And he's asking for them, for Tommy at least, and other chimps to be in sanctuaries. There are, and we have done shows on this, it's no question that there are animals like chimps and elephants. He's dealing with elephants as well, and other animals that have been shown to have a lot of self-awareness, awareness of past and future. They have languages, they use tools, they grieve, they empathize, they pass knowledge from one generation to the next. The main question, which we'll ask him here in a moment after we get to a few calls, is whether or not we already have animal protection laws on the books that would get Tommy out of his cage, that it would be illegal for Tommy to be in a cage, or is it time to move, as we learn more about these animals, to another level, to not think of them as things? What do you think? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Stephen. Stephen Wise, president of the Non-Human Rights Project, teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont, Lewis and Clark University of Miami, St. Thomas Law Schools, and has taught at Harvard Law School and other places. Author of, most recently, Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Kyle in Stevens Point is our first caller for you, Stephen. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
So my question for the guest is, I'm thinking of Roe versus Wade that comes to mind when I hear what this guest is speaking about, trying to determine the rights of animals through the court system. And ever since Roe versus Wade was decided, there's been this big debate about when life begins. And a lot of commentators would say that the court shouldn't have gotten involved. This should have been an issue that was left to the legislature. So I'd like to ask the guest why he feels that the courts should be deciding this issue and not state legislatures.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. Stephen?
Sure. Well, Roe v. Wade was an interpretation of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. It involved the issue of whether a human fetus was a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. Human fetuses are persons in every state, usually for purposes of the common law, which is the law that judges make, state constitutions, state statutes, but they're not persons, at least right now, under Roe, within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. We think that that the common law and not the Constitution or a state statute is the place to go, because a common law court has the duty to make the common law harmonize with modern scientific discovery, with changes in philosophy and morals, with accruing experience. And one thing I did in preparing for this is I wrote a book in 2005 called Though the Heavens May Fall, which talked about how the black slave named James Somerset was able to use the common law writ of habeas corpus in the Court of King's Bench in London, the exact way that we're using it on behalf of Tommy, which is to say, under the common law, under the common law writ of habeas corpus, the court should take certain considerations of justice, or should use certain considerations of justice and use its power to expand the protection and reach of the common law writ of habeas corpus to someone who is really entitled to it. And we're saying that the purpose of a common law writ of habeas corpus is to protect the autonomy of someone who is autonomous is now being imprisoned against her will. And that it doesn't matter what species she is. If she's autonomous and can be injured by being put in solitary confinement, as Tommy and the other chimpanzees can, then a writ of habeas corpus is appropriate. And not only is it appropriate, but for a common law court, it's really part of their job to do justice, to look at Tommy's situation and the situation of the other chimpanzees and use their power and do their duty under the common law writ of habeas corpus to extend its protection to them.
Thank you very much for the call. What do you make of the opposition to what you're doing that was outlined in this New York Times article? The NYU law professor, Richard Epstein, who says, and I quote, there are already ample protections available under current animal welfare laws on both the federal and state levels without having to go down the practically and philosophically fraught path of extending a human right to a non-human.
Well, that issue, probably not unsurprisingly, came up in our oral argument at the Supreme Court, which is the lowest court in the state of New York. And we think the Tommy case is a perfect illustration of that. We concede that the way Tommy and the other chimpanzees are being treated are entirely legal. What we're saying is that you can obey all these animal welfare laws and you can still keep a chimpanzee locked in a cage for his entire life. So Richard Epstein is wrong, because and the Tommy case and the other chimpanzee cases illustrate how he's wrong. And so we told the judge the only way of possibly getting Tommy out of his solitary confinement is through a writ of habeas corpus, because none of the present law is sufficient to do that.
Thank you for your call. Raymond in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Wasn't it Gandhi who said you judge a nation by the way that nation treats its animals? I think is a beautiful thought, and I really want to thank your guest for what he's doing, and maybe at the end of the show he could give an address or something where we could send money to help him out in this fight. But what's going on in Milwaukee? Recently we had a dog stolen out of a backyard, and the dog was burned over 90% of its body. And from what I understand, the maximum this man can be fined is the value of the dog, if you were to buy the dog at a, you know, at a puppy mill or whatever. That's the maximum fine this guy could get, and I'm just outraged by that. I'd like to see this guy really, really, like, have to spend time in the burn wards, maybe for 4 or 5 years, I don't know, something else like that. I myself have been behind bars, and the way we treat people in this country is just kind of mind-blowing, but UWM here in Madison has chimpanzees, they have dogs, they have cats, they even have fish that they're experimenting on. And if you win this case, are you going to start directing yourself towards freeing these caged animals at all these universities across the country?
All right, thanks for the call, Raymond.
I think what we're doing is we're going to have our hands full for a long time. Because a common law writ of habeas corpus is not a federal issue; it's a state issue. So we have to go, you know, state by state. So I think what we intend to do is to look at those non-human animals that we think we have good, strong scientific evidence that they are autonomous, that they can self-determine, and those we think are the great apes: chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, gorillas. Some cetaceans, orcas and whales, the African and Asian elephants, and maybe the African gray parrots as well. And so we're going to have our hands full for a long, long time just trying to persuade courts in all of the states to first kind of bang through the wall that separates all legal things from all legal persons and kind of bring these sorts of non-human animals into the embrace of legal personhood. And then once a non-human animal is a person, for example, say Tommy has a right to bodily liberty, the question then is, well, what other rights might he have? And so those will take more suits, and so I think we're going to be occupied working on those animals for a long, long time. But in doing that, we know that legislatures, you know, all over the United States are going to jump in. If, you know, once we win, everyone's going to have something to say about it. And it's very hard for us to predict what, you know, all the directions that this is going to take.
And do you answer that for yourself? Do you have the answer to that once Tommy might be granted bodily liberty? Do you know what other rights he should have or what you would like for him to have?
The two that I've been thinking about and arguing about for the last 30 years are bodily liberty and bodily integrity, that he shouldn't be allowed to be imprisoned, and he shouldn't be allowed to be the victim of what on a human being would be an assault and battery. So you can't cut him up, you can't use vivisection. And you know, it turned out when I began this 30 years ago, you could do just about whatever you wanted to a chimpanzee, and they were done. To my utter astonishment, in June of 2013, the National Institutes of Health really freed virtually all of their chimpanzees, all except 50, and sent them to sanctuaries, saying, and that's because the NIH also recognizes that they are extraordinary beings. They're extraordinarily cognitively complex. They are autonomous, and it's simply not right to keep them in prison and do things to them the way we have been for so long.
Let's go to Kurt in Springbrook next. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, I was just wondering if your guest is familiar with Thomas Lindsay's work in the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, who's working to extend rights to all of nature. And if he is, if there's similarities between the two, or that's all I really wanted to know.
I know a little bit about it. I think we'll just start with Tommy, and I'll leave all of nature to him.
Tim on Facebook, I think you'll probably agree with this, and can amplify this, says, if our courts can rule corporations, which don't have hearts or brains as legal persons, I see no way that they could rule chimps as non-persons.
That is an interesting question, because sometimes, or oftentimes, even judges automatically, almost instinctively equate persons with human beings. And in fact, our very first paragraphs in our brief say that a person is not a human being. And we attack that in two ways. A person is not synonymous with a human being. We show that until the 13th Amendment in the United States, that black people in the United States were both human beings, but not persons. They were seen as legal things. And on the other side, you have corporations, ships, partnerships. You have all kinds of non-human entities that are persons and not things. But they can even be said to be an extension of persons. So we kind of move out to other common law countries, other English-speaking countries, and show, for example, that a Pakistani court has held that a mosque is a person. A pre-independence Indian court held that a Hindu idol was a person. In 2000, the Indian Supreme Court held that the holy books of the Sikh religion was a person. And in 2012, there was a treaty signed between the indigenous people of New Zealand and the Crown in which it was agreed that a river was a person. So clearly a person is not a human being. It can be a human being, but it can be something else. What we're arguing a person is it's an entity that the legal system has decided will count.
Hmm. Interesting. You mentioned other countries. Are there other countries conducting similar efforts?
We are ahead. I'm happy
are
to
we?
Say, I guess, that the Non-Human Rights Project is really at the forefront throughout the world. But we are rapidly networking with others, trying to work with them to do similar things there. I just came back from Argentina last Saturday. I was in Switzerland 2 weeks before that. I'll be in Spain, and in a week I'll be speaking in London in 3 weeks. And you know, I'm going to Sweden. We are networking and beginning to work with lawyers and law students and others throughout the world, trying to basically train them and work with them and to encourage them to begin to try to have their legislatures or courts declare that a non-human animal such as a chimpanzee is a legal person, and really kind of break through that legal wall between things and persons that really exists everywhere, and
mm-hmm.
and start having courts not just automatically reject the claim of a legal right by a non-human animal because she is a non-human animal, but to look at her and say, well, what kind of a being is she? What kind of internal life does she have? What does she feel? And does the right she claim, is the right she claim a suitable one for us to declare?
Hmm. More phone calls. Join our conversation. Stephen Wise is our guest, president of the Non-Human Rights Project. And his whole story was featured in a very lengthy piece, New York Times Magazine section late in April, and it caught our interest. And it was titled, Should a Chimp Be Able to Sue Its Owner? So we thought we would talk about that. And it's a fascinating story. 800-486-8655 is our number. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And let's go to Lynn in La Crosse. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My husband and I adopted an African gray from a bird rescue about a year and a half ago, and she has many behavioral issues, but we love her and we're working with her. But I'm curious if you could speak to the topic of African grays will live a long life if they're taken care of. And we're in our 50s, and she may outlive us. So I'd like to hear more about how we take care of her, besides giving her to a rescue place after we're gone.
Well, even though it's not exactly up my alley, it is kind of. I think every state now, except perhaps one, and it's not Wisconsin, has passed some sort of what's called a pet trust statute, where you can now set up a trust to take care of your animal after you die. And if you go see a lawyer and you say, hey, there's a pet trust statute here, how do I set that up? Who's going to be the trustee? How much money are we going to need? How long is he or she expected to live? I think that will put your mind at ease.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Where is Tommy now, Stephen?
Tommy is sitting in his cage in Gloversville right now.
Is he?
I just spoke to Tommy's captor's lawyer a few minutes ago because we have been trying to persuade Tommy's captor to voluntarily move Tommy to one of the sanctuaries that has agreed to take Tommy. So far, he's refused to do that, and so we're just ready to push forward as fast as we can to get our case in front of the appellate courts. And right now, Tommy's case is either going to be argued the first week of October or the second week of November.
Hmm. Well, we go to Kim in Madison next. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I guess this links into one of my favorite topics is corporate personhood. I just don't know. Apes use tools. They think they have a pulse, their heartbeat. So if anything, they should have personhood rather than a corporation. That's my comment.
Thank you,
well,
Kim.
Personhood, as I was saying before, is really the legal system's acknowledgement that you count. And at one time, all human beings did not count, and they were not all persons. And now the courts and the Constitution statutes say that fetuses may or may not count, corporations may or may not count, partnerships, ships. It depends upon whether or not a court or a legislature believes that the entity ought to count. And we're simply saying that because of the extraordinary cognitive abilities that a chimpanzee like Tommy has, that it's arbitrary to say that Tommy's not going to count. Because if a being like Tommy, who is so extraordinarily mentally complex, who is autonomous, who can self-determine who has culture. I mean, he's extraordinarily similar to us. If he's not going to count, and this is an arbitrary decision, then exactly why should I be why should I be so certain that I'm always going to count? Because if you can prevent such complex beings from being legal persons, then perhaps you can start excluding other extraordinarily complex beings, like certain kinds of human beings, from being persons as well.
Let's go to Clyde in Grafton. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
I concur and agree with your guest's assertion and belief that entities, that living beings other than human beings should have and do have rights. However, I strongly disagree, and he's making a serious mistake when he asserts that the Constitution allocates or recognizes the rights of anything other than living human beings. A big example, a really important problem that we have is that corporations have claimed that they are persons under the Constitution, and this has been fraudulently, without justification, unjustifiably asserted the legal doctrine that, by golly, a corporation is a person, and therefore it has the rights defined by the Constitution. That's a big problem, and it's certainly unjustified, and it's also, whether we like it or not, unjustified to say that our U.S. Constitution gives rights to any beings other than living human beings.
Stephen.
Well, our Constitution is an interesting document. It's very short, and it allows an enormous amount of room for interpretation. It clearly did not give black people rights, certain kinds of rights, and it just uses the word person with respect to the 14th Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, and so it's been up to the United States Supreme Court to interpret what the document means. And since, I think, the Santa Clara Railroad case, I think that would maybe have been 1874, when all of a sudden the Supreme Court said corporations are persons. Well, if the Supreme Court says it, there's nothing I can do about it. So I just have to operate under the assumption that the courts are going to recognize that corporations are persons. You know, one thing that the Non-Human Rights Project does is not, or one thing that we don't do, is we're not trying to change the law at all. What we're saying is, what we're saying to courts are, we're asking you to accept the law as it is now, to accept the principles that you say you value, to accept the values that you say you espouse. And we're saying, using those principles and values, Tommy and other chimpanzees have to be legal persons, or you have to admit that you're acting arbitrarily.
Mm. Thank you so much for the call, Clyde. I'm wondering if you had some formative experience, Stephen, in your life. That did you have some kind of encounter with a chimp or an elephant, or you read a paper about how extraordinarily intelligent they were? Or what was it that, of all the fields of law, you're carving new territory here? Did you have some experience that made you do this?
I liked animals, I guess.
I
had companion animals at dogs and cats, but the reason that I became a lawyer, I was a lawyer out of my work in the Vietnam and anti-war movement, when I became kind of exquisitely attuned to ideas of justice and fairness, and that's really why I became a lawyer, and that was in 1977, and I was just doing that kind of work when, you know, 3 years later, I pick up Peter Singer's book and I say, oh my goodness, I had no idea that I was involved really in treating non-human animals the way they were. And I thought that there was no one else, I thought at the time, it turned out there were some, but there weren't very many, that there was no one else who was going to stand up for them and try to do something for them and stop the injustices that were being perpetrated on them. And so I saw no other field of law in which I could make as big a difference as if I began to be an advocate for the rights of non-human animals.
Hmm. Stephen Wise, our guest this hour, president of the Non-Human Rights Project. Go to their website because it will detail what's going on in the courts now with writ of habeas corpus and the chimp, Tommy. We're asking whether or not, as the Times did, can a chimp sue its owner? Do animals have any kind of legal rights? Is there a hierarchy of animals that are very intelligent and empathetic and have a sense of being able to communicate with each other and pass on information to the next generation? And do they receive legal personhood, which entitles them to rights, in Tommy's case, to get out of the cage and be in a sanctuary somewhere? We welcome your phone calls. Our number, and we've had pretty filled lines, but there are lines open now, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now. Let's go to Dave in Milwaukee next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you? Sure.
I'm well. The question that I had was, in your guest's mind, what is his ideal situation if he hypothetically wins this case and obtains freedom for these chimps? What is freedom for a chimp that's been raised in captivity?
Well, that is a really good question, and it's one that we had to deal with from a legal basis, because usually remedy for a writ of habeas corpus is simply to open the prison and allow someone to leave. And we were able to find a number of cases involving writs of habeas corpus that had been granted, for example, on behalf of 8-year-old slave children in the 1840s. And we were very carefully trying to figure out what had happened to them. And it turned out that they were sent to somebody who would take care of them. And we're doing the same thing. We can't send them back to Africa. Chimpanzees would almost certainly die. And so what we're doing is we have arranged with the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance to evaluate any chimpanzee who we can free, and they will send them to the most appropriate of their 7 member sanctuaries throughout the United States. And one of them is just 100 miles up the coast from me in South Florida, Save the Chimps, which is a place where they have a man-made lake, and they have 13 man-made islands in the lake, and there's about 25 chimpanzees who live together on each of the islands. And we're urging that Tommy be sent there, where he will spend the rest of his life in South Florida, which is a better place than upstate New York, and where he will live not in a cage, but he'll be living free on a 3-acre island, and he'll be living with others of his own species, and he'll live a life that we think is as close to being the life that he might live, were he back home in Africa, that he can possibly get in North America.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Dave? No, thank you very much. Anne in Green Bay, hi.
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 How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. I just wanted to say to the guest, thank God that you're doing this. I think it's about time. I think for all of us that have owned dogs or cats, we know that these creatures don't deserve to be treated in so many of these ways that humans have been treating animals. And I think it's about time someone stepped up and did what you're doing, and I'd like to thank you.
Well, you are very welcome, and I will pass that on to the other, dozens of hardworking people at the Non-Human Rights Project. Mm-hmm.
So she mentioned dogs and cats, and we mentioned the animals that have this ability to be autonomous. We listed how smart they are and what they do. That's really quite incredible. I know you've got your work cut out for you, but I guess we have to wait to see what happens scientifically, what we learn more about how cats and dogs operate and how other animals do as well, to add them to the list. Am I right?
That's right. And we don't know because there hasn't really been that much research done on dogs. There's been some, and it's growing. There's been almost nothing on cats. And, as a trial lawyer, What I'm interested in is the peer-reviewed science that has been done that I can bring into a courtroom, and I can feel confident that the science will stand up. It'll stand up under cross-examination, and it'll be persuasive for the court. So that's why we began with chimpanzees, because we think that the science there is as clear as it can be, and it's only getting clearer. One thing I do want to note is that we are not saying that one must be autonomous in order to have rights. We aren't giving an opinion on that at all, but we're saying that if someone is autonomous, then he or she should be a person and should have certain kinds of rights that flow from that autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to that, what's this guy's name, Richard Epstein, that NYU law professor who's quoted in the New York Times Sunday Magazine piece, that the potential practical consequences, he says, of what you're doing, Stephen, we would eventually abolish long-established institutions like the agriculture and food production industry.
Well, thank goodness we don't eat chimpanzees. So I don't think that by freeing Tommy and sending him to a sanctuary that that for good or ill, it's not going to affect the agricultural industries.
Mm-hmm. And tell me the response. I mean, you must be taking some people by surprise. I don't know, the court clerks or some of the judges, because this hasn't been done before. What's the response to you? What are judges saying? Are they surprised by this?
Well, we have actually been surprised by the response worldwide. We thought that we were going to get our head handed to us, and we have had unanimous, you know, hundreds and hundreds of media outlets have given us almost unanimous praise. There have been some people who don't like us at all, and they're very vocal about that. But on balance, we have been the subject of accolades, which we think would probably stem from the fact that we spent 30,000 hours working on our case.
Ooh.
We think our papers are excellent. We think our arguments are excellent. We think that the facts we have, are persuasive,
mm-hmm.
and we don't see why a judge or anyone else would look at our papers and say this stuff is a bunch of malarkey, because it's clearly not. That doesn't mean we're not going to win, especially the early cases, because as the one judge said in the Niagara Falls case, you know, I'm not going to be the first one to take this leap of faith, and there may be other judges out there who feel that they don't want to be the first ones to take that leap of faith, which is why I come back to my book, Though the Heavens May Fall, which told the story of James Somerset, the black slave in London, where he encountered Lord Mansfield, who was a judge who had the courage to take that leap of faith and say that black people could not be slaves. And, you know, we're really looking for someone who, you know, is a Lord Mansfield or half of a Lord Mansfield who's willing to say, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do the right thing.
Yeah. And this is you've been at this a long time, a 25-year project. You put a date, I want to be successful, I want to have the first judge say,
well, actually,
right?
I was going to be a 30-year one. I started in 85, and I thought we would be filing first suits in 2015.
Oh.
It turned out that I was 2 years early, so after 28 years, I thought the time had come, and I sometimes explain that we filed suit in December 2013 because we thought in all of history that now was the time in which the science and the law had progressed to the point where we had some reasonable chance,
mm-hmm.
of winning. And if we don't win the first time, then the fifth time, then the tenth time, then the 50th mm-hmm. time. But you know, we think our arguments are excellent, both from a legal and from a factual standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And the website where people can follow your court cases and find out more about you is what, Stephen?
It's www.nonhumanrights, all one word, .org.
Nonhumanrights.org,
or we're on Facebook, too. We're also on Facebook, too.
All right. Stephen, thank you so much. It was a fascinating hour. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Our guest this hour is Stephen Wise. He is president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He is he teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont Lewis and Clark University of Miami and St. Thomas Law Schools, and he's taught animal rights law at Harvard Law School and John Marshall Law School as well. We also reference, if you want to see a picture of Tommy, he's on the cover of the New York Times Sunday Magazine section, April. Oh, what's the date? Last Sunday in April, the whole story about Tommy is there. And that's what caught our attention. That was interesting, huh? Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks to Marika Suval for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where the sun is shining. Great conversations ahead. I'm off next week. I have a bit of a vacation, so the wonderful Mr. John Munson will be with you. Hope you have a good Memorial Day. And thank you very much for listening. So, you know, until a little while from now. This is the Ideas Network.